And this is WMNF in Tampa. Thanks for listening to 88.5 FM, the Bay Area's non-commercial radio station. Coming up next, we're going to hear the Tom Hartman program. Janelle Irwin is taking the next 2 weeks off, but she will be back. And thanks for tuning into Midpoint. It's a program that airs every weekday from noon till 1 o'clock. So today we're going to go out to Portland, Oregon, where Tom Hartman, a progressive radio host, hosts a national call-in show. We're going to hear that call-in show right now.
Well, it's a foggy day here in Portland, but it's a good end of the week. So Donald Trump is trying to commit treason right now, and his Republican allies are in on it with him. Along with a no shortage of right-wing hate radio hosts and, the Fox Network and others who are actively taking a sledgehammer to our democracy. This is wrong, and every American should condemn it. We have so far two Republican senators, Ben Sasse of Nebraska and Mitt Romney of Utah, who have come out and said, yeah, Joe Biden won the election. How do you have a functioning Democratic Republic when the guy at the top insists on ignoring the basic tenets of democracy, or of what Jefferson referred to as Republican government? This is how countries die. There's a great piece over at Medium.com written by a person who lived in Sri Lanka, talking about how in Sri Lanka, something very similar happened. The loser in an election protested and squealed and yelled and got their supporters all cranked up and ultimately lost. But 4 months later, there was this giant bombing that killed a couple of hundred people at a church, and that provided the necessary crisis moment for that original guy who lost, for his right-wing supporters to come in and take over the government and start imprisoning and killing people. I mean, that's where we're at right now. Trump is not going to be successful in this. But in the process, he is doing great damage to our republic. And he's doing it because he's trying to stay out of jail. And I suppose I can understand that. By the way, it's Anything Goes Friday. It's just you and me all day. We'll be taking your calls. I suppose I can understand that if I was in elected office, if I was the president, and I knew that if I lost the election, I would be going to prison, then, you know, pretty much nothing would be off the table. Well, you know, it's hard to speak for myself, but, you know, because there have been no shortage of people in the history of the United States, including the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence, who were willing to put themselves were not just sentenced to prison when they signed that document. They were sentenced to hang, every single one of them. Articles of sedition and treason were drawn against every signer of the Declaration of Independence. Every single one, if they were caught by the British, was to be hanged. And they knew it when they signed that document. So, you know, just be real facile and say, well, maybe I would, you know, screw the country in exchange for staying out of jail. I don't know if I would or not. Those are those horrible things that you don't know what you're made of until you confront the crisis. But I can tell you, we can see what Donald Trump is made of. He's scared silly. This guy is peeing his pants. He's so afraid of going to prison. And he knows he's going to go to prison. And he's going to lose his empire. And it's looking now like, you know, the state of New York is looking to put his daughter in prison for tax fraud, among other frauds. I mean, there was all that stuff with, what was it, 50 Wall Street, whatever that building was that Trump owned, where both Ivanka and I believe it was Eric were in on some kind of sales scheme, and the DA almost brought charges against them. There were a whole bunch of complaints. I mean, this is the bottom line. He's trying to avoid jail. People say, oh, he's playing six-dimensional chess. No, he doesn't want to go to jail. People are saying, oh, well, in fact, I have said, he's feathering his nest for the future, right? He's building his list of supporters. He's trying to get people on his side. He's going to milk them as much as he can. He's going to have a TV network afterward. All that probably true. But the level of vigor, the level of energy, the level of, I mean, flying in the Speaker of the House of Representatives from the state of Michigan and the majority, the Senate Majority Leader, these two Republican leaders from Michigan, flying them into Washington, D.C. for a meeting at the White House, that goes way beyond trying to get your Republican supporters to you know, feel nice about you. You know, this is not some Glenn Beck move, you know, where you lose your gig on Fox News and so you start your own TV network. This is not some Ron Paul thing where you lose your election to the House of Representatives and so you decide to start publishing a newsletter. Ron Paul is still publishing the newsletter, right? Right-wing crankery. .com or whatever it is, and making a living off it. But, you know, this is not that. This is a man who does not believe in democracy, who thinks that cooperation is for suckers, that the world is made up of two kinds of people, killers and losers. He has said that in at least two of his books, that he was taught this by his father. And if you're not a killer, you're a loser. And there's nothing in between. Good, normal people who believe in the rule of law and just do their job every day and raise their families and put their kids through school, that doesn't exist in Donald Trump's world. You're either a killer or a loser. And he has been a killer his entire life. And now he's been very successful as a killer as president. We have 250,000 dead Americans. And the election results say, hey, Donald, you're a loser. And he's not dealing with it well. In fact, there are psychologists suggesting that he's experiencing hypomania, which is this, you know, grandiosity and you get super voluble. You're constantly, you know, speed rapping and talking and not sleeping and it's like it's mania. And it sure looks that way. And that's often triggered by what you would call a mental breakdown. I mean, this is a guy who has been hiding the fact that he is not a billionaire his whole entire life. He's been making up myths about himself, you know, calling reporters and pretending to be a guy named John Barron and talking about how Marla Maples said it was the best sex ever and getting that as the headline in the New York Post or whatever the tabloid was. I mean, this is how he has lived his life, running a grift, running a scam. And it no doubt started when he was in elementary school. Or early, you know, middle school or high school. I'm not sure what grade he was in when his parents finally said, that's it, we can't stand this guy. There's something wrong with him. He is broken. We're going to send him off to a private school. No real military academy would take him. So they sent him to a pretend military academy where everybody wore uniforms and saluted and they had ex-military as teachers, but it wasn't really a military academy. And then he got out and he hired people to take his exams for him. His niece says he hired somebody to take his SAT. One of his teachers said he was the stupidest person ever and rarely showed up for class. And God only knows who wrote his exams. I mean, keep in mind, this was in the 60s. I was living out in East Lansing. And one of my best friends started a little business. I mean, it was actually legal back then. This must have been 68. Where he was running ads in the local underground paper. It was called The Paper, by the way. In fact, I lived at the office where the paper was written and published. It was called The Paper Office, and it was kind of the local hippie crash pad. And he was running ads in the paper saying, hey, you want to buy a term paper? I'll write the term paper for you, $30. And he made a good living because there were no shortage of rich people who, you know, rich kids at MSU who were more than willing to pay to have a term paper written. This is Donald Trump. This is his life story. He's always gotten his way. And for the first time in a big way, he's not getting his way. He's not accepting it. And he's willing to break our country. He's willing to destroy the future of our children and grandchildren just to avoid going to jail, just to avoid being called a loser, just to avoid his father's voice in his head. This man is mentally ill. And Mike Pence should be invoking the 25th Amendment right now and bringing the cabinet together and getting him out. And the rest of us need to call it what it is. It's sedition and treason.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that said, I will pick up your calls for the next 3 hours. We will have a conversation about this and whatever else is on your mind. I got a few other news things here to share with you. And welcome back. Stephen in Clifton Heights, Pennsylvania. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about something entirely different as opposed to the election. I'd like to talk about Grover Norquist and the Americans for Tax Reform.
Okay.
As you probably know, or at least you may know, it's a failed experiment. It's simply not working at all.
You're referring to his organization or the idea of signing a thing that says no new taxes or what?
It's the idea of signing a pledge that states I will never raise taxes, not even to balance the budget. Right. That to me seems so strict, so rigid, that you just have to wonder, well, why are we so deep in debt, $24 trillion? Well, the answer is very obvious. It's simply because taxes cannot be raised at all. We have natural disasters in this country, for example, and sometimes we need more money than is available at that time. And simply because of that, we're just strapped. We simply have to borrow money that we don't really have.
Yeah, and the simple fact of the matter is that had Reagan not dropped the top tax rate from 74% down to 25%, Clinton took it back up to 30, whatever it was, 38, 39, and then George W. Bush comes in and drops it back down another 7 or 8 points. Again, most of that tax cut was weighted toward people in the high end. And then Donald Trump does. If you add up all those tax cuts and you add in the cost of the Iraq and Afghanistan war, that is 100% of our budget deficit. And yet these guys, their general hysteria, oh my God, look at the deficit, we're going to go broke, family couldn't have this kind of credit card debt. Well, first of all, the United States is not a family. We issue our own currency. Secondly, we've been this far in debt before. We were this far in debt after World War II. And how did we get out of it? We borrowed more money. Eisenhower borrowed more money and built the interstate highway system. And it so reinvigorated the American economy, this massive infrastructure project, that within 15 years, we had largely paid off that debt. And then Reagan came into office. There was only $800 billion in the national debt by the time Reagan came in 1980. And, with Jude Wodinski's two Santa Claus theory, when Republicans are in office, run up the debt as fast as you can and take the stimulus from that and take credit for a good economy. And then when Democrats come into office, pull out that stimulus and start yelling and screaming about the debt. And that's exactly what's been going on for the last 40 years. But you're right. You're right, Stephen. Grover Norquist, he was kind of the tip of the spear. He wasn't alone in this. This was something that was signed on to by every single Republican. And most of them are continuing to say this. I mean, this is, you listen to the Republicans on MSNBC and the Never Trump Republicans who have shows now on MSNBC, and every now and then the subject will wander close to something like expanding Social Security or improving Medicare or Medicare for all, and all of a sudden they start to just reflexively almost convulsively going deficits.
Can't have deficits.
Stephen, amen. Thank you. Grover Norquist, by the way, has been a guest on this program many times. What strange times we live in. We'll be right back. It's coming up on 20 minutes past the hour. I'm speaking at the Bioneers 2020 conference. It's running December 5th and 6th and 12th and 13th. My keynote is how all life is organized around democracy. Tickets are available at bioneers.org, and there's a 20% discount with the code TOM, T-H-O-M. So back in 2018, Bayer, the German pharmaceutical company, bought Monsanto, the American chemical and pesticide company. And, you know, God only knows what else, you know, seeds and whatnot. Anyhow, Bayer bought them for $63 billion. Bayer just very recently set aside $10 billion to cover the cost of consumers, people in their homes, who bought Roundup and got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, cancer, from Roundup, this product that Monsanto makes that Bayer now is responsible for. $10 billion. The kicker is that the home use of Roundup only represents about 10% of Monsanto's sales of this product, glyphosate. It's amazing. There's a whole video about this for our the people who support our program over at TomHartmann.com. You can check it out over there. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. The other big news, that you know happened yesterday, and I was looking for my article on this. I know I printed it out this morning, but I can't find two other big news stories that I want to share with you very quickly, and then I'll get back to your phone calls. The first is that Steve Mnuchin sent a letter to the Fed yesterday, and this is a big deal. You've heard, you know, in fact, yesterday. I'm looking for the article here. Oh, here it is, right here. Yesterday, I was talking with economist Richard Wolff, and we were discussing the fact that the Fed has basically created $3 to $4 trillion out of thin air, and used that money to loan it to big corporations, giant corporations, you know, publicly traded corporations. And to buy their stock, something, both things that the Fed has never, ever done before. What we didn't get into when Professor Wolff and I were talking about it yesterday is that what gave the Fed the arguable authority to do this was the CARES Act, this piece of legislation that was passed back in March that gave everybody $600 a week. It also allocated a little short of $1 billion to give it to the Fed. And the reason why is that the Fed, and I don't pretend to be super knowledgeable about all the inside workings and how this all works, but here's the 60,000 foot view. The Fed can loan money to businesses that are in crisis, and they can buy stock in the stock market, or at least they're asserting that right. But they have to do it with authority from Congress, and they have to do it with basically some seed money from Congress. You know, the way our banking system works, if you deposit, $10 in your bank can loan out $100 based on that. There's this, it's called fractional reserve banking. So this is how money is created in our economy. A small amount of money goes into a bank, and then the bank can basically create a large amount of money by loaning it out to people. And the Fed does the same thing. So Congress gave the Fed a bunch of money, a few hundred billion dollars that they gave to the Fed. And then the Fed was able to leverage that money to use to make trillions of dollars to extend the economic recovery, principally the stock market. Well, yesterday, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, sent a letter to the Fed saying, you can't do that anymore. I mean, and there's just a freak out article about this over on the Financial Times website. The headline is U.S. Treasury refuses to extend some of Fed's crisis fighting tools. The facilities, I'm reading from the article by James Politi in Washington and Colby Smith in New York. In a letter to Jay Powell, the Fed chairman on Thursday, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, asked the central bank to return unused funds from five emergency programs ahead of their expiration. The facilities include two schemes to purchase corporate debt, five facilities. See, keep in mind, this is stuff the Fed is doing to prop up our economy. Mnuchin is trying to, these are like the legs that hold up a table. Mnuchin, one at a time, is pulling these legs out. Why would that be? Because this is all going to hit in January, and the table's going to collapse on Joe Biden. That's what they're doing. So back to the article from the Financial Times. The facilities that Mr. Mnuchin is looking to end include two schemes set up to purchase corporate debt, five facilities created to lend to medium-sized businesses, collectively known as the Main Street Lending Program, one program to lend to state and local governments, and another to support asset-backed securities, that is to support the stock market. The Fed, in response to this letter from Mnuchin, issued an absolutely unprecedented press release pushing back, saying, quote, the Federal Reserve would prefer that the full suite of emergency facilities established during the coronavirus pandemic continue to serve their important role as a backstop for our still strained and vulnerable economy. In his letter to Mr. Powell, the Treasury Secretary said the end of the emergency credit facilities would free up $455 billion, okay, so it's a half a trillion, in funds that could be spent on other things by Congress. We want our money back. Markets reacted swiftly to the Treasury announcement. The S&P 500 futures contract slid 0.9%, while NASDAQ futures were down 0.5%. This is from, you know, I printed this last night. But, you know, we can see this right now. Look at the stock market. Stock market is going down, and it's going down rapidly. Why? Because our Treasury Secretary just, if this stands, just stopped the Fed from supporting our economy. And lacking any more direct payments to individuals, which all expired a few months ago, so we're no longer getting extended unemployment. And by the way, 20 million people are going to lose their unemployment benefits the week after Christmas because all this stuff is expiring. And on top of that, Mnuchin is saying the Fed can't support the economy anymore either, which means that as Joe Biden walks into office, he may be well walking into a repeat of the Great Depression of 1929. That's how bad this is. And that's how vicious and mean-spirited these SOBs are in the White House.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
I mean, for months now, they've been preventing any kind of aid to average working people. Now they're cutting aid to people who are invested in the stock market.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For the Tom Hartman Book Club today, we're reading from George Packer's new book, Our Man. It's the subtitle is Richard Holbrook and the End of the American Century. This is from the prologue. Holbrook, yes, I knew him. I can't get his voice out of my head. I can hear it saying, you haven't read that book, you really need to read it. Saying, I feel, and I hope this doesn't sound too self-satisfied, that in a very difficult situation where nobody has the answer, I at least know what the overall questions and moving parts are. Saying, gotta go, Hillary's on the line. That voice, calm, nasal, a trace of older New York, a sing-song cadence when he was being playful, but always doing something to you, cajoling, flattering, bullying, seducing, needling, analyzing, one-upping you, applying continuous pressure like a strong underwater current, so that by the end of the conversation, even 2 minutes on the phone, you found yourself far out from where you'd started, unsure how you got there, and mysteriously exhausted. He was 6 feet 1, but he seemed bigger. He had long, skinny limbs and a barrel chest and broad, square shoulder bones, on top of which sat his strangely small head, and encased within it the sleepless brain. His feet were so far from his trunk that as his body wore down and the blood stopped circulating properly, they swelled up and became marbled, red and white like steak. He had special shoes made and carried extra socks in his leather attaché case, sweating through half a dozen pairs a day, stripping them off on long flights and draping them over his seat pocket in first class, or else cramming used socks next to the classified documents in his briefcase. He wrote a book about ending the war in Bosnia, the place in history that he always craved, though it was never enough, with his feet planted in a Brookstone Shiatsu foot massager. One morning, he showed up late for a meeting in the Secretary of State's suite at the Waldorf Astoria in his stocking feet, shirt untucked and fly half zipped, padding around the room and picking grapes off a fruit basket, while Madeleine Albright's furious stare tracked his every move. During a video conference call from the UN mission in New York, his feet were propped up on a chair, while down in the White House Situation Room, their giant distortion completely filled the wall screen and so disrupted the meeting that President Clinton's National Security Advisor finally ordered a military aide to turn off the video feed. Holbrooke put his feet up everywhere in the White House, on other people's desks and coffee tables, for relief and for advantage. Near the end, it seemed as if all his troubles were collecting in his feet. Atrial fibrillation, marital tension, thwarted ambition, conspiring colleagues, hundreds of thousands of air miles, corrupt foreign leaders, a war that would not yield to the relentless force of his will. But at the other extreme of his feet, the ice blue eyes were on perpetual alert. Their light told you that his intelligence was always awake and working. They captured nearly everything and gave almost nothing away. Like one-way mirrors, they looked outward, not inward. I never knew anyone quicker to size up a room, an adversary, a newspaper article, a set of variables in a complex situation, even his own imminent death. The ceaseless appraising told me of a manic spirit churning somewhere within the low voice and languid limbs. Once in the 1980s, he was walking down Madison Avenue when an acquaintance passed him and called out, "Hi, Dick." Holbrooke watched the man go by, then turned to his companion. "I wonder what he meant by that." Yes, his curly hair never obeyed the comb, and his suit always looked rumpled, and he couldn't stay off the phone or TV, and he kept losing things, and he ate as much food as fast as he could, once slicing open the tip of his nose on a clamshell and bleeding through a pair of cloth napkins. Yes, he was in almost every way a disorderly president, but his eyes never lost focus. So much thought, so little inwardness. He could not be alone. He might have had to think about himself. Maybe that was something he couldn't afford to do. Leslie Gelb, Holbrooke's friend of 45 years and recipient of multiple daily phone calls, would butt into a monologue and ask, "What's Obama like?" Holbrooke would give a brilliant analysis of the president. "How do you think you affect Obama?" Holbrooke had nothing to say. Where did it come from, that blind spot behind his eyes that masked his inner life? It was a great advantage over the rest of us because the propulsion from idea to action was never broken by self-scrutiny. It was also a great vulnerability, and finally, it was fatal. I can hear the voice saying, "It's your problem now, not mine." He loved speed. Franz Klammer's fearless downhill run for the gold in 1976 was a feat Holbrooke never finished admiring until you almost believed that he had been the one throwing himself into those dangerous turns at Innsbruck. He pedaled his bike straight into a swarming Saigon intersection while talking about the war to a terrified blonde journalist just arrived from Manhattan. He zipped through Paris traffic while lecturing his State Department boss on the status of the Vietnam peace talks. His Humvee careened down the dirt switchbacks of the Mount Ingmar Road above besieged Sarajevo, chased by the armored personnel carrier with his doomed colleagues. He loved mischief. It made him endless fun to be with and got him into unnecessary trouble. In 1967, he was standing outside Robert McNamara's office in the second floor of the Pentagon, a 26-year-old junior official hoping to catch the Secretary of Defense on his way in or out for no reason other than self-advancement. A famous colonel was waiting, too, a decorated paratrooper back from Vietnam, where Holbrooke had known him. Everything about the colonel was pressed and creased, his uniform shirt, his face, his pants carefully tucked into his boots and delicately bloused around his calves. He must have spent the whole morning on them. "That looks really beautiful," Holbrooke said. And he reached down and yanked a pants leg all the way out of its boot. The colonel started yelling. Holbrooke laughed. George Packer's book, Power Man. On this week's Science Revolution, Dr. Jason Hill with the University of Minnesota says cutting greenhouse gases from food production is urgent and that our food systems may be the dark horse of climate change. Investigative journalist Catherine Eban drops by in her new book, Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. Mari Margill with the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights will be telling us about the huge win in Florida for the rights of nature. Tune into the Science Revolution wherever fine podcasts are available. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. By the way, wow, news travels fast, apparently. Other people are reading the Financial Times with the same whoa that I was yesterday. Claudia Sahm, S-A-H-M, this just went up like an hour ago on the New York Times. I just caught it during the break. I was just checking all the news reports to see if, you know, frankly, what I've been looking for is any word on this meeting between the Michigan guys and Trump. But anyhow, the headline is Trump trying to take down, to take the economy down with him? And then the subhead, his Treasury Secretary is shackling the nation's central bank and closing an emergency program for local governments. And as I said, that's exactly what's going on. I just tweeted that story out just a second ago with the note that in the Bible, this is, you know, when people would leave occupied lands and they wanted to just trash those lands so that the people who used to live there or who were going to live there next wouldn't be able to live there. What they would do is they would pour salt in the fields, which makes, you know, kills all the plants and prevents anything from growing for years until that salt washes out. And they would put poison in the wells. And that's what Steve Mnuchin is doing to the Fed right now. It's just mind-boggling. So, anyhow, as I said, anything goes Friday. Jerry in San Francisco. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You've probably heard some of the nurses recounting their recent stories of people coming in with COVID and still don't believe there's that disease exists. And yes. They're fighting, telling the nurses to take off their gear, that they don't have it, and then they try to get a kind of a communication or a Zoom with the home, and the people say, "Let us in there. There's no such thing as COVID. You're blocking us from seeing our loved ones," and so forth. And I was, you know, my daughter's going to be going into nursing school in January, and I know your daughter is already doing work. This is, yeah. I mean, we couldn't have fought World War II with this kind of situation that we have now of Americans fighting against Americans. It's just the stupidity is beyond what anything that I can even comprehend. What do you think?
Right. And I absolutely agree with you, Jerry, and I think it's really important for Americans to understand where this started. In 1980, this right-wing fringe that had been in the 1950s basically all outraged over the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the John Birch Society, funded in large part by Fred Koch, Donald's father. Fred Koch paid for billboards all around the country that said, "Impeach Earl Warren." And because, oh my God, my white kids might have to go to school with a black kid. And that right-wing movement that just swept the country. I mean, my dad took me to one of these meetings in like 1961 or 62, a John Birch Society meeting, and somebody gave me a copy of John Stormer's book, None Dare Call It Treason, and I took it home and I read it cover to cover probably three times. And it was all about how the State Department was filled with communists. And I was freaked out, you know, and that's why I went door to door with my dad in 64 when I was 13 for Barry Goldwater. But the point is that movement was being funded by billionaires, or what in today's money would be billionaires, like Fred Koch and like the H.L. Hunt and his brother down in Texas. And these guys were on a Jeremiah, on a campaign, on a hate campaign against government, because they saw government as regulating their lives. Government was going to the Supreme Court in this case specifically, but then Congress implemented laws to even put that, you know, Brown decision into law. Government was going to force their white kids to go to school with black kids. That was their initial major freak out. And then that got added to with, oh my God, you know, Richard Nixon signs the Environmental Protection Agency into law in 1972, I think it was. And then the oil billionaires, and again, Fred Koch and now his sons, went into hyperdrive. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Now they're going to regulate the oil industry and the Environmental Protection Agency. Are you kidding? And the developers got in the act. Wait a minute, we've got to do environmental impacts before we can, you know, rip up a forest and put in a bunch of you know, subdivision. And so this meme that developed, that came into full bloom in 1964 with the nomination of Barry Goldwater as the Republican Party's nominee for president. The essential core of their argument was that government has become too powerful. Government is forcing our white kids to go to school with black kids. Government is forcing our businesses to not, you know, to stop polluting and poisoning people. Government is trying to regulate. The other big freakout was the seatbelt stuff. This was Ralph Nader in the 70s. Unsafe at Any Speed was published actually in, I think, 67 or 68. But between that and Rachel Carlson, I mean, this is why in 1971 in the Powell memo, Lewis Powell specifically named Ralph Nader and Rachel Carlson and said these, who had started respectively the consumer movement and the environmental movement. And he said, these people are promoting communism. They're going to destroy the American way of life, and they're going to destroy the American system. And what Lewis Powell refers to it as the American system four or five times in the Powell memo. And what he means basically is unregulated, unrestrained capitalism and all this kind of stuff. So this, Barry Goldwater ran on this, and he was still considered a crackpot and a fringe guy. He lost so badly in that election of 64, yeah. And then what comes along is Ronald Reagan in 1980. Finally, they get one of these right-wing crackpots into the White House. And the first thing he says to the American people when he's inaugurated on January 20th, 1981, his opening speech to America is, government is not the solution to your problems, government is the problem. And so these guys who didn't want government telling them that their white kids had to go to school with black kids, and then expanded that to say we don't want also government telling us that we have to treat our workers well, that we have to pay a minimum wage, that we can't trash the environment. These guys took over our government, and they took over the Republican Party. And this anti-government thread, at the time, back in the 80s, there were those of us who were saying, if this thing reaches its logical conclusion, you're going to have the destruction of the United States. What these guys are actively, openly advocating really is the destruction of government. And now you get Steve Bannon, months after Donald Trump is sworn in, some reporter said to Steve Bannon, what's your primary agenda? And he said, the deconstruction of the administrative state. Well, what's the administrative state? It's called the federal government. What does deconstruct mean? Tear it down, destroy it. Our goal, Steve Bannon said, in effect, of the Trump administration, our goal is to destroy the American government. And they have largely done it, but they've taken a good chunk of it out. And now Donald Trump is running around with a sledgehammer, trying to break everything he can. And frankly, I think one of the reasons that he's trying to stop the transfer of the transition to Joe Biden is he doesn't want the Biden people coming in while he's in the middle of destroying all the evidence he can destroy. I think that they're going to do once they figure it out that it's lost. There is going to be you're going to have shredders running 24/7 in the White House. Back to you, Joe.
And then in the process, they've also destroyed science, facts, and so forth. Yep. And so now you
and
see
faith
that
in
people
those.
Don't believe things that are right in front of their eyes.
Right. Anthony Fauci has to have a security detail for his wife and kids and grandkids because he's getting death threats from crazed right wingers who have been believing this Goldwater, Reagan, Trump stuff that the government is lying to you. And now the government has gotten these scientists to lie to you, too. And it just goes on and on and on. And it is so destructive. It is so destructive. Jerry, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. David in Los Angeles. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Tom, it's very fortuitous, your rant that you went on in reference to minutiae and this stock market. But anyhow, I've been calling my Congress people all morning long, dealing with this McConnell leaving and taking all of his boys from the Senate home during this period, right? Now, what I've been saying to my Congress people is that they were complaining about defunding or reimagining the police. This clown is literally defunding America. That includes
right the police, and the police in the process,
nurse, and everybody, you see. And so it's like, where is the outrage with this? And this has been going on since Nancy had put forth out of the House the HEROES Act, right?
Yep.
This and that HEROES Act included all the municipalities and everything that needs to be funded in this space and time where everything is getting ready to collapse. So, I mean, it was like fortuitous, Tom, to hear you do your rant. So I think this kisses what you're talking about. And that, yes, what they're trying to do is to collapse the system. actually. And so it's like the oligarchs have won. We have been sitting up against socialism and communism during the Cold War and whatnot, but we never imagined that the oligarchs or the imperialist capitalists were also competing for America. And I think they have won.
Well, I don't think they've won yet, David, but they're 90% of the way there. And hopefully they have awakened enough Americans that we can push back and fight back. I mean, this is very much like the 1920s. The oligarchs had taken over. That was the roaring 20s. The oligarchs totally took over. And they crashed the system, and America rebooted in 1933. And I think we're about to reboot again. David, thank you for the call. So well said.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you want to complain about people saying defund the police? Mnuchin just defunded the police in cities all over America by cutting the Fed facility to support municipalities. And welcome back. John in Seattle listening on KBCS. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hello, John.
Yeah, Tom. Like you, I was born in Michigan. My grandfather was a state senator, in fact, and so I feel very, very strongly about this. And, you know, I think we should change our terminology. Instead of saying Trump is pressuring or Trump is negotiating with these people, we should just say outright what it is. He's trying to bribe them. And with his power in the presidency, he can offer them head of a commission, some monument naming commission or ambassador to Grenada or something like that. And I think
you're talking about like the state board of canvassers guys from Michigan or the legislators.
Yeah, any of those folks. He's got to be doing something like that, because that's the one thing he's got.
Oh yeah, he's totally transactional. I agree.
And so we should just start saying, hey, the Trump is bribing them. But you know, one other thing that comes to mind with all that is, if this were any sort of illegal, like a trial or something like that, this would be witness tampering. This would be jury tampering. Mm-hmm. And so there must be some sort of laws against that. And if there aren't, we damn well better get those started soon in states, federal, whatever. But
yeah, anyway, I'm completely with you, John. Yeah, I think that what we're and really the question that should be being asked, and I need to probably ask it more frequently on this program, is what kind of bribes are Trump, you know, what are the bribes that Trump is offering to these Republican officials who are responsible for certifying the election in these various states? Because we know, you know, he tried to bribe the president of Ukraine. He begged the president of China to help him out. He had some kind of deal going with the president of Russia back in 2016. This is what he does. He essentially pays people off. Yeah, I'm totally with you. It's terrible. Thank you for the call. Louisa in Roseville, California. Hey, Louisa, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I hope you're well.
I am so far.
Wonderful. I've got 2 points I'd like to talk to you about today, kind of briefly.
We have just 1 minute, so pick one.
Oh, okay. Last week I called about the illegal ballot drop-off boxes here in California that Republicans place in 3 counties. And I did a follow-up call to the Secretary of State, and I talked to a gentleman there who said that he thought that almost all of them had been picked up by the Secretary of State office and disposed of, but we don't know whether all of them had been. But also the voters who dropped their ballots off there had all been instructed how to resubmit their ballots. So at least we know that was taken care of.
Resubmit? You mean the phony ballot boxes that the Republicans put out were not, they didn't take the ballots to the secretaries, you know, to be counted?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that's what happened, but from what this gentleman said is that they informed all of the voters who had dropped off their ballots in those boxes how to resubmit their ballots. That's what I was told.
That's amazing. Louisa, if you learn anything more, give us a show, would you? This is a story that's worth keeping track of. What happened to the ballots in those phony ballot boxes that the Republicans put out? It's amazing. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls on whatever may be on your mind today, whatever topic you want to talk about. Pigeons, flying saucers, the weather, Trump treason. Share the Tom Hartman Program with your friends. We're available on SiriusXM, Free Speech TV, Pacifica, commercial stations nationwide, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, on the Tom Hartman app, and you can even tell your smart speaker to listen to the Tom Hartman Program. So for our Tom Hartman Insider videotape YouTube, whatever you want to call it, private video that's available over at TomHartman.com, I'm talking this week about Donald Trump just completely giving in to Erdogan of Turkey, the president of Turkey, the dictator of Turkey now, and this theory that Jared Kushner okayed the killing, at least the capture, perhaps the killing of Jamal Khashoggi and to Mohammed bin Salman, and that Erdogan has the tape of it. And that when he called up Donald Trump a couple weeks ago and said, I want you to pull out of Syria and give me those Kurds so I can kill them and take that land, that he did it because Erdogan threatened him. And then Erdogan comes to the United States, a week or two later and gets a whole state dinner thing. Check it all out. It's over at TomHartman.com. I think you'll find it fascinating. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and picking up your calls. Jerry in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I was my dad was in the Second World War, and he was in Germany and in Europe. And I was thinking about the invasion in Normandy. If the leaders of the Republican Party had been the Allied commanders, And I can imagine the headline on that was on June 6th. On June 7th, the headline in America would have been "Invasion canceled. Allied commanders fear tweet from Hitler and Truman." What kind of courage does the Republican Party have? If they're afraid of a tweet, we'd be speaking German right now.
Yeah. And, so far, we have Mitt Romney and Ben Sasse. And I, in fact, when I get off the air, I'm going to send them both a tweet saying thank you for being patriots. Though I disagree with almost everything they stand for, and they're still standing with Mitch McConnell to block any kind, as are David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. They're all standing with Mitch McConnell to block any kind of aid to Americans, but still, they're at least standing up to this proto-fascist in the White House. Excuse me, Jerry,
back to you. And also, I wondered if we couldn't start we had profiles in courage. Could we start a profiles in cowardice or in treason? And also, Benedict Barnold, okay, we should do something about him. I have one question for you, though, talking about with the idea of how do we unite the country? Well, our problems, in my mind, started when Reagan eliminated the Fairness Doctrine. That's what brought us to Limbaugh and Fox and MSNBC. We have allowed people to gravitate to places where they only have their personal prejudice reinforced, and they never hear the other side. And I think that that's one of the reasons that our country is so divided.
Yeah, I don't entirely disagree. The Fairness Doctrine was much more limited than most people realize. It didn't say that if you carry 3 hours of Rush Limbaugh, you have to carry 3 hours of Tom Hartman. What it said was when a radio or television station offers an editorial opinion, in other words, when the owner or management, I used to work at Channel 6 in Lansing, WJIM-TV. This was back when I was 17 years old. I was a floor director there. And
Did you know John Gebhardt? Okay, he worked there too. for years.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was. It was a great job. They even had an a little cafeteria and lunchroom where we had they fed us. You know, it was a really good meal. But in any case, when I was working at WJIM TV as the floor director, I would manage the guy who owned the radio station. WJIM was named after Jim, who was the kid of the family who owned the television station. Excuse me. They also had a TV radio station, WJIM Radio, and he would go on the air and he would say, "Here's my opinion." He was the owner of the television station, and he would say, "Here's my opinion. I think that we shouldn't build this new bridge, to connect the Potter Park Zoo to whatever." And because he did that, he would then have to be followed by a member of the community saying the opposite. So if he gave 2 minutes, the community member got 2 minutes. But it was only the owner of the station. It was only the editorial voice of the station. If he had chosen to put on a program, the Joe Pine Show back in that day or something like that, there didn't need to be any balance for that. So, the Fairness Doctrine did two things. Number one, what I just described. And number two, it required that radio and television stations actually produce carry what was called programming in the public interest, which was interpreted to mean news at the bottom of the hour on radio and news for at least a half hour during prime time on television. And the networks produced that news at great expense. Really high quality news, bureaus all over the world, and they all lost money on it because it was the price of their licenses, that they had to have that. So when the Fairness Doctrine went away, that was the major impact. I was living in Germany at the time when Reagan nuked the Fairness Doctrine, and I remember driving down the street in the Autobahn listening to this story about how the Fairness Doctrine is gone now. And thinking, okay, that's going to be the end of news. And sure enough, within 6 months, the news division at CBS News, was put under the supervision of the vice president for entertainment programming. It had gone from being something that they lost money on, but they provided really a public service. They lost money on because that was the cost of keeping their license. It went from that to being something that would produce a profit. And what happened with the news then was that it went from being, these are the things that real serious journalists and scholars believe every American should know about, it went from that to whatever's going to get the most eyeballs. If it bleeds, it leads. What's the most sensational, weird thing out there? That's what we're going to cover. And that is the kind of mentality that brought us Donald Trump and the Republican primaries. Jerry, I got to run, but thank you for the call. We'll be back in a few minutes here after the break at the top of the hour and continue with Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh he'll want it. By the way, did you see this thing? COVID-19 causes impotence? Amazing.
That was Tom Hartman. This is the Rolling Stones.
Oh yeah, I was fine.
And this is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 on the left side of your dial. Best little radio station on planet Earth. Stay tuned for NPR News. Then Joellen's here with Art in Your Rear. She's in the studio ready to go, so don't go anywhere.